everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk and to this part two of a conversation with Lauren Kreslove. Lauren Kreslove is one of the founders of the Pacifica radio station in Washington, D.C., WPFW 89.3 FM. Lauren Kress talks about the loss of two of her sisters, including the noted Dr. Frances Kress Welsing. We continue to hear from Lauren. Lauren Kreslove, welcome to Mind Talk.
And thank you very much for the invitation, and I'm glad to be here.
Lauren, I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about the impact from your perspective of racism on the mental health of persons of color, specifically African Americans.
So how much time do we have?
Oh, about 18 years maybe.
Well, yeah, that's a very deep subject.
Yes.
And I say that the impact of racism on people of color started when slaves were, or Africans were kidnapped, and one way or another began to be marched to the coast of Africa, countries, African countries, and put on slave ships. That's, I would say, the beginning of the impact on our mental health. Because there's a continuum. See, there's not been a moment stop in time since the first African was put on a slave ship. And life is a continuum. And experiences are continuous from parent to child, from parent to child, from parent to child. There's not been a break in our history and in our time, in my history, in your history. There's not been a break since your ancestors were brought here in slave ships and forced to undergo the horrors of the Middle Passage. So we don't really think about the impact of the kidnap and enslavement as part of our history, but we're connected. There's not been just because we don't know who the ancestor was doesn't mean that we didn't have an ancestor.
That's true.
It just means that we don't know their names, and we don't know those great-great-great-great-great-grandparents, grandmothers and grandfathers who endured the horrors of that Middle Passage, chained in those dungeons. I mean, what was their condition, mental condition, when they came off of the boat? What were their thoughts? What were their feelings? We still embed those thoughts and feelings, whether we're conscious of it or not, so that we have to take ourselves back to almost back to Africa to begin to undo or to assuage the pain. We have not, because we learn in the Western tradition, like Kaji Woodson talked about the miseducation of the Negro. We are so miseducated, but not just us, everybody is, because the information and the lines and the history that was distorted when Alexander went into Egypt and stole the and burned, killed the priests and stole the books and et cetera, et cetera. That break in the understanding of history and the human condition is a part of the Western tradition of thinking, and that's why it's so stupid. And that's why we're in the dilemma that we're in terms of war, in terms of the environment, because it's all compartmentalized, and we're not taught to understand everything is everything. Everything is everything. So, in terms of our history, We're still suffering from being kidnapped. We're still denying that we're Africans. And I say that either you're from slavery or you're from Africa. Choose. Now, if you choose Africa, then you need to somehow make a hook, identify yourself with a country or not a country, but just with the idea of us being the original people, the mothers and fathers of civilization, because that's who we are.
Absolutely.
And then we need to figure out why we are here, because there must be a cosmic reason for us being here.
You know, I was doing a program sometime back, and we were talking about, actually, as I think about it now, I was actually doing a program specifically around your sister, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, and her loss and her teachings, and talking about the need, as you said, I mean, the need for us to celebrate and respect ourselves in a way that too often we don't. And I can't tell you the number of emails that I got from folks annoyed because it seemed like I was, quote-unquote, dissing white people. It was really quite something that there is this sense that if we are going to be proud and respectful of ourselves and our own resources and our own resilience, that somehow that means that we are opposed to somebody else, when in fact that's kind of what other people do.
Well, let me say this about dissing white people. I am dissed as a black person every single day of the year in America. When I turn on the television, when I open magazines, when I open books, I am constantly dissed by the lack of including people of color in publications, on television, in important roles. You know, like we got 40-something Congress people, black Congress people, in the Congress of the United States. How many times do you ever see one of them referenced for some information? Never, hardly ever. You know, so how many times are other African-American people of import and great knowledge referenced around any situation? So I am constantly dissed, and I feel dissed. When I open a magazine and I'm told that here's the most beautiful woman in the world and she's white-skinned and straight yellow hair, I'm dissed. How could she be the most beautiful person in the world when maybe I should be, or some other woman of color? What about our men who are constantly dissed when all the great white hope of America are white? No, we're always dissed. So no one has an right to talk about their diss. We're all black people are dissed in this country every single day of the year, constantly dissed, not just by police, but by every element of life in America. And until black people start talking about that and resisting being dissed, they'll continue to be dissed.
One of the requests that I asked during that program was that as we think about ourselves as people of color, as African Americans, that we stop getting caught up in who looks like what and what complexion who is and what kind of hair he or she has. Because it's still so much, it seems to me, a part of the world in which we live. And I, quite frankly, don't think we need to help other people hurt us.
Well, until we get deeply in love with ourselves and every aspect of our beingness, we're going to still have these problems. And until we really understand why these problems exist and then figure out how to bypass them by loving ourselves more, feeling good about ourselves more, respecting ourselves more, then we're going to continue to have these problems. I mean, I think that the major problem that we have is how we see ourselves and how we feel about ourselves. And these ideas and attitudes were forced on us. So it's really difficult to get out of it. But we have to find the means to do that.
Because that is our survival.
Yes.
Speaking of survival, let's shift again. Let's talk about today's political madness, if you will. Dare I ask you what your thoughts are about the tenor of our politics in the world today?
Well, I must say that I have not been focusing on the political situation, the current one today, too much, because I have been involved for the last number of months, first with the illness of my sister Barbara, who died on the 20th of February, but who has been ill off and on for some time. So I've been kind of skirting this circus that's been going on. I think, though, generally it speaks to the tenor of the quality of leadership in America. I think that this country is losing its mind. And I think that part of the reason that it's losing its mind is because it has not confronted its major issue, and that is racism, white supremacy. So you can, it takes a long time sometimes for a situation to develop and then to go through its various cycles. But the moment that this country and the so-called founders wrote a document creating all men as equal, and at the same time holding thousands and thousands of people in an unequal position, it wrote its death knell. Because you cannot, if they had written all white men are created equal, that would have been a good thing for them. But to write that all men are created equal was the dilemma that they have found themselves in, and they have not been able to extricate. And that is the major issue that is destroying the country in so many ways. So, I mean, all this jumping up and down, you know, by this clown who could become the president of the United States is really horrifying. People are saying they're getting their passports. They're running out of the country. Instead of stepping up to the plate, and speaking truth, they're not doing that. They're fearful of doing that. So I don't know if that's responded to your question.
Completely. And it took less than 18 years. That was really quite impressive. You know, there are certainly people nowadays who say, and I'm talking about Africans, African Americans, who say that they do not experience racism, that they don't know what's being talked about, and that that was old school, and they're tired of hearing about it because it doesn't affect them. Can you speak to those folks?
Well, sooner or later, even those people who really don't want to talk about it, because it's painful to talk about this stuff.
Indeed.
You know, this is painful. As a psychologist, you know yourself, the people that you work with or experience whose lives have been stopped or held on hold as a result of an experience, a racist experience. I'm certain that you know of people.
Absolutely.
But every child, every school child, black school child in America is a victim of racism, white supremacy. If they are not learning the names of all the African-American heroes and African heroes in the history and the roles that the people like them have played, they are victims and they are being they are victimized from the very beginning. What about mothers, pregnant mothers who don't have opportunity for adequate prenatal care, who are black or brown, or bringing children into the world? Those children are right then and there victims as they are birthed, because they're not getting the kind of nurturing and care, adequate natal care, prenatal care, that is needed to develop a person and a human being as strong and with dynamic abilities. So we're victimized from the get-go, from the get. And even if people don't recognize that, it's not because they've not had the experience. It's because they're so numb to the experience that they just don't feel it anymore. I mean, what about brothers in these prisons who cannot read and write, who went to public schools where they were treated badly and now find themselves in jail? They may not see that as racism, white supremacy, but I can guarantee you that it is, because they have been jailing African-American men in one form or another ever since the end of slavery. And we have been, people need to read Douglas Blackman's book, Slavery by Another Name, to understand the kinds of things which preceded Ferguson. But it was the same kind of activity where people were arrested and used as to work in the steel mills and to work on farms and other industry and not paid. So they may not understand that that was racism, white supremacy, but that's exactly what it was. What do people think slavery was? And it's, you know, it's really, we don't even need to argue that, because sooner or later, whoever these people are, they will run into this experience of being black in America. Ask the President of the United States.
Absolutely.
Ask Barack Obama and Mrs. Obama. Ask them, the highest office in the land. Ask the president about experiences of racism, white supremacy, that he endures and experiences every waking hour that he is in that office.
That is so true. And I am, you know, I'm thinking about the folks who, the post-racial crew, you know, you have to at least acknowledge that they exist. And that in and of itself,
well,
but you tell me how it strikes you.
I don't know any post-racial people, maybe because of my age group. We just not into post-racial.
You know better, but, huh?
But there's no such thing as post-racial. That's just hope. That's fear. That's hope and fear. And that's people who think that they're moving into situations, oh, well, let's ask them where they live. Where do these people live? Where are they trying to live? And are they still trying to live in Washington, D.C., or in other inner cities where we're being forced out of by something called gentrification, which is really a major white supremacist activity? Ask them how much they're paying for rent, or can they even buy where they want to buy?
Absolutely.
In their post-racial America.
Gotcha. I'm thinking that you're thinking it doesn't exist. Is that a fair observation?
Listen, you got it. It's a dream. It's a dream by someone having a nightmare that they don't want to confront.
What do we need to do as a people? What do we need to do to protect our mental health, to protect our emotional wellness, to survive?
Well, I think that in order to protect one's mental health, one has to understand who one is and where one is. And so it's like, find out who you are and then find out where you are. And if we understand who we are, if we embrace ourselves, we substantively embrace ourselves, which is not easy. Because it's not easy to, you know, look at your black face in the mirror and then see the beauty when you've been, you know, in programmed, literally programmed to see something else as beauty. You have to, you know, it's like going on the inside of your mind and scraping stuff away. It is not an easy task to come into your sense of self. That is hard work. And we have not had the programs available to us on a large scale that can help us do that. But that has to be done. I mean, we have to almost like go back to Africa and kiss the ground and then come back and have some people say, welcome home, we're sorry we let you go, and then decide to come back to America to really get whole. Because we're the only group of people in this country who did not come here from someplace else on their own volition. Everybody else in this country who they themselves or their ancestors or others came here from someplace else on a decision to come here from someplace else for all the same reasons. I don't care what language they speak. They all come here saying either I or my grandfather, my great-grandfather, great-great, however, came to America to make a better life for themselves. Now, the only group of people who did not do that are us, the descendants of people who were enslaved, kidnapped and enslaved Africans. We did not come here on that purpose line. And so, to some extent, we're still trying to wonder why are we here? You know, that's why we keep saying, what's happening? What's going on? Because we ain't in it, and we don't know. And we didn't come here on that dream. And we have not changed our minds. We can transform, be ye transformed, Romans 12:2. Be ye transformed by the renewal of your mind. Now, that is what we need to do, because we need to understand that we didn't come here on our own purpose. And we're still operating on somebody else's purpose, even to this very moment.
Chris Love, I would like to, with your permission, read a Pledge of Allegiance for Black People that your sister, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, wrote. May I?
Yes.
It is entitled, A Black Oath, A Pledge of Allegiance for Black People. I pledge allegiance to my own black self-respect and to the self-respect of all other black and shades of black people on planet Earth, all of whom are victims of the system of racism, white supremacy. And I pledge to use all of my life energy, intelligence, and creativity in all areas of people activity to eliminate the global system of racism, white supremacy on planet Earth, and to replace it with justice so that there can be peace. So help me God. And again, this was written by Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. Lorne, what's your feeling as you hear her oath?
Well, I think that it's courageous. It's genius. And I think that black people and people of color everywhere ought to adopt that pledge and that oath and wake up every morning and repeating it to themselves as they start out their day of dealing in a country or in a world that still is attempting to deny their greatness.
I would also like to suggest that as this oath is repeated on a daily basis, that it's done so looking in the mirror at your own reflection.
Mm-hmm.
I think that could be a very powerful experience. Just to say, I pledge allegiance to my own black self-respect,
mm-hmm.
and to the respect of all other black and shades of black people on the planet Earth. If that's all you feel like you have time to say, that in and of itself is a powerful reminder.
I agree. And I'm very glad that you read it. You know, we did read the oath and the prayer that Frances also wrote at the memorial service. And, you know, that really speaks to her genius. You know, she, not only did she write a book, not only did she write, you know, her first small pamphlet, The Crest Theory, and then the ISIS papers, but she was constantly thinking of ways to help us develop stronger sense of self. And she never stopped. Frances never stopped creating, thinking, how can I help my people? So I thank you so much for reading that oath, and I hope that people will get copies of it and to learn it and repeat it as you suggested. I think that's a wonderful idea.
And Lorne, what I would like to read again with your permission is the prayer, a liberating black people's prayer for justice and peace.
Yes.
And this is to be said and envisioned when in prayer, and it reads thusly: Thou who art blacker than a trillion midnights, whose eyes shine brighter than a billion suns, thou whose hair doth coil tighter than a million springs, radiating all energy throughout the universe, we beseech thee, one and only one, to give us total strength to carry out thy will for the universe, to establish justice on planet Earth and live in peace. This was written by Dr. Frances Cress Welsing in 1996. Lauren?
Mm-hmm, yes.
What are your thoughts?
Well, we read that at the memorial, and the fact that she says to be read while envisioning, while seeing, and taking what one sees in, you know, thou who art blacker than, what is it, a trillion midnights, or, I mean, I think that the wording and the idea and the concept is marvelous and is substantive. We need to begin to see ourselves as marvelous and as beautiful in our own color and in our own hair that coils like springs. These were words that she used so that we would begin to see and appreciate ourselves and our difference as beautiful and marvelous. We have to do that if we are to regain sanity. Because as long as we're attempting to mimic someone else and to be like someone else, we are insane. And I would say that a psychiatrist's duty was to help heal mental illness. And so certainly her poem and her oath were a part of that mission.
And a mission certainly that was well energized, not only by herself and her own passion, but I know the passion of the Kress family. It sounds like the Kress family has been on a mission for a very long time.
Right, I guess maybe ever since great-grandfather came down from Canada to fight in the Civil War, you know, we have had our mission forwarded. Frances felt that she had a cosmic assignment, and that her mission was, as it was a cosmic assignment, assigned from the Creator. And I think that she was right. And so we intend to continue that mission by making more of her work available and making her tapes available to people, her lectures, so that people can really read and study. I say that not just for Frances's work, but the work of many of our scholars. You know, people buy the books, but we don't study the books. We don't study the books. We buy them and they sit on the shelf. So we need to really go back and study. What were these people really saying? What was their charge? What was Carter G. Woodson's charge to us? What was he talking about? Why did he say miseducation of the Negro? And how come we haven't taken him more seriously? You know, that book is as old as I am, you know, and that's getting up there. It's older than me.
Just a little bit.
It was published in 33.
Lauren, tell us about the Kress Welsing Institute.
Well, the Institute was founded by Frances. It came out of a series of lectures that she and Neely Fuller did way back, just as the Kress Theory was published, and even before that, just as people were helping Neely to publish and get his writings in the United Independent Compensatory Code for Victims of White Supremacy. Neely and Frances lectured together or up at Howard at various buildings, and then at some point, and I don't remember exactly when that was, Frances began to lecture or began to conceptualize the concept of the Institute. I don't know the exact dates that happened, but I do know that I moved to D.C. in 1970. No, 70. I moved here in 72. And she was beginning to lecture at, I think, the Howard Inn. And forming the Institute, developing the kind of framework for what was ultimately called the Kress-Welsing Institute. Now, that went on the second Thursday of every month from September to June for about 30 years at Howard. And there are students and people who have studied with Frances for well over 20 years.
And we're talking about Howard University in Washington,
D.C. Yeah, Howard University in Washington, D.C. She began her lectures there at the Blackburn Center and has been lecturing. And the Institute really consisted just of Dr. Welsing in terms of lecturing. And she used that opportunity to explain her theory and how it works and what it does, what it means in the lives of us, every month, the second Thursday, as I said. She also, part of the program was the distribution of a pamphlet of papers, which were reprints of various articles from newspapers or other printed material that was reflective of her theory on racism, white supremacy, whether it was for or against. And so Frances would call newspapers, other people would send her information, and then she would have this, these articles reprinted in her packet of information that was a part of, you know, a regular part of the Institute. So that's basically what the Institute was and is. What form it will take now that Frances is no longer among us is not totally decided, but people who are you know, members of the Institute certainly want it to continue. So we will be working together to see how we can make this new edition of the Institute work. Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, Lauren, if you can talk for a little bit about your sister's stay at Howard University.
Well, you know, Frances was, you know, a graduate of the medical school and had been hired to teach in I mean, she's a graduate of Howard, you know, and she was teaching in the medical school, and it was at the time, around that time, and I don't have the years, that somewhere around that time that she met Neely Fuller. And Neely, Frances began to study with Neely Fuller and his theories on racism, white supremacy, and his United Independent Code for victims of racism, white supremacy. And people have to read Neely Fuller because his philosophy, his theory, is profound. Frances began to, as a result of her studying and understanding Neely's definition and of racism, white supremacy, and what it is and how it works, as a psychiatrist, she began to ask the question, why? If there is such a thing as a sense of superiority, why would these people think that they were superior to other human beings? And what is it that would make them feel that different? And as she began to look across the board, She said that the only difference that she could determine that made people who lacked skin color different was that they did lack skin color. So my father, who was a physician, as was his father also, but my father said to Francis, who wondered about this lack of skin color, look at the melanocyte. Look at the melanocyte. And Frances did, and she began to understand where color comes from and that the lack of color is a recessive trait. It's really albinism. That's what lack of color is, albinism, and it's a lack of ability to produce melanin. And that it's a recessive trait, and that if a person of color and a person who lacks color come together through a sexual act, the result is going to be a person of color. And so Francis began to say that this was, that racism, white supremacy, is, as the brothers, fear of the black planet, fear of losing their racial identity, fear of racial annihilation, and so that the rest of the colored world is being held at bay by a small minority of people on the planet Earth who really number one-tenth of the world's population. So that was the beginning of her theory on the Kress theory of color confrontation. When she, while she's still teaching at Howard, she's teaching at Howard and has developed this theory, which she was quite proud of. But as she presented her paper to various people at the university, she began to, find rejection. And she was actually told by the head of the medical school not to publish her paper, which she did, and the rest is history. She was not given tenure, and she left Howard University as a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that part of history with us. We know you and I have been talking for a while now, and we have certainly made several references to the loss of your sisters. As you move forward now in your own life, what would you like, or is there anything that you would like from listeners, from just sort of people who have loved your family and your sisters and you around the world? What will help you in your time of grief and healing?
You want to know the real truth?
Yes.
Birthday cards.
Okay.
I'll be 82 on the 31st of March. And only today or yesterday did I realize that, you know, my sisters always sent me birthday cards, and we always sent birthday cards to each other. And, I don't have sisters anymore. And this is really, I'm sure that there's deep grief that I have not even tapped into out of fear. I do know that one can heal, and that one does heal, and that one heals, especially if one acknowledges that one needs to heal. So I don't fear that at all, but I do know that I thought about it today and yesterday. Wow, my birthday is coming up, and I don't have any sisters to send me birthday cards. So anyone who wants to send me a birthday card can send it to me.
And how might they send it to you?
Well, they can send it to me at Dr. Weldon's address, which is, gee, I don't even know the address at this minute. I've really drawn a blank. I don't know where I live. Hold on.
Folks, you are listening to a conversation with Lorne Kress.
I cannot believe that I cannot, that I have.
Well,
forgotten where I live.
I have to tell you that your memory skills actually astound me anyway. So I kind of want whatever you're taking because your memory skills are blowing me away. So if you can't pull up an address right this minute, that is perfectly fine. We can work that one out. are you in
6025 16th Street Northwest.
6025 16th Street Northwest. Okay.
20011.
Are you in the D.C. area for a while now?
I'm back and forth between here and Chicago, so I almost don't know, you know, when I'm leaving here and going back to Chicago. I don't have a set plan just yet. But I will be here for a while, yes.
Okay.
And I'll be here back and forth here. Mm-hmm.
As we wrap up our conversation today, and I know that I have kept you long after the time that you agreed on, so I appreciate your patience. Is there anything more that you would like to say to your sisters or to the listeners?
Well, what I'd like to say to my sisters is that I definitely love them and miss them. You know, the three of us, it's like in any family, different people play different roles in a family. And some people take on this and some people take on that and some people take on the other. Well, with the three of us, we had always been, if something was going on with one of us, then there were the other two to deal with it. And so that up until my sister Barbara's death in February, at least, you know, she was there once Francis died. But now it's like you turn to the left and right, and so there's no one there, but they are there. And so I send them love. And what I want people to do as far as the memory of Frances Welsing is concerned is to read her book and to understand what she was attempting to tell us about where we are, where we are. If we can understand where we are, that this is not the land of the free and the home of the brave. You know, it's really a land of cowards and people who have refused to step forward and look at the truth and look at the truth of their history and then to make some apology in some way and say, we are sorry, and to work to change their own minds, just as we as African-American people have had to suffer and work to change our minds about the programming that was put on us. So my wish is that people would study Frances, but not just Frances. Any black writer and educator, pick up a book, and let's move away from these television programs that really only demean us ultimately. I mean, they're set up, they're glamorous, they're, oh my God. But are they helping us free ourselves? I don't think so. So I think we people need to get back to books and read and improve their beingness. We have to improve our beingness so that we are strong, our backs are straight, and we're able to face this critical question of racism, white supremacy, and with dignity, with great self-respect, Because once we respect ourselves and love ourselves enough, no two things can occupy the same space at the same time. So we will meet this challenge and we will be victorious.
And on that, I will simply reread a sentence from your sister, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing's Black Oath, just to remind folks. As she wrote, I pledge allegiance to my own Black self-respect and to the respect of all other Black and shades of Black people on the planet Earth. From Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, Lorne Cress, love, thank you. Thank you, thank you for your time today, for all of the work that you have done. Do you have any sense of what's in the future for you?
A lot of work in pushing my sister's work forward.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you've certainly got a lot available to you to do.
You know what's in the future for me? Another thing I'll tell you. I want people to support WPFW. I really do. And it's not because I am one of the founders of that radio station, but it's because it's an important entity in our community, and I want people to support that station. And that's what I'm also going to spend some time addressing.
Wonderful.
How can we help make this station better and better and better?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. Certainly, as we've said, WPFW is an icon in the community and needs to remain so and to become stronger and stronger. So thank you for that as well.
Well, thank you.
All right. Lorne Cress Love, I'm going to let you go. But again, thank you for your time today and for the work that you're doing.
And I thank you. And I thank you for the work that you're doing. It's very important.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is available to you daily on demand at myndtalk.org. That's myndtalk.org. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. The best way to be in touch, though, is through the website, and that is myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. And folks, just a reminder, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.